the people who work on Uber and Deliveroo like that. They don't want to work shifts. They like the fact that they can log on whenever they want to. But the problem is this. If you can log on whenever you want to, and if you're entitled to minimum wage when you log on, the danger, of course, is that in such a system, we will realise that what we should do is set our alarm at 2 o'clock in the morning, log on for Deliveroo. Not many people want pizzas at 2 o'clock in the morning, so we can lie in bed. We might occasionally have to get up and deliver a pizza, but we can happily be earning our minimum wage doing nothing. In those circumstances, Deliveroo would have to say no. Well, we'll have to control the number of people who are working, and then you move to a shift system. So, brilliant, in my view. I don't care if it sounds arrogant. We thought very hard about it. Our brilliant response to this was to say the following. If the platform, and these platforms have huge amount of data, if the platform can demonstrate that the average worker working averagely hard earns 1.2 times the minimum wage, so not just the minimum wage, 1.2, that means even if you're not terribly efficient, you'll still get the minimum wage. If secondly, they continue to adhere to this way of working, which is you can work whenever you want to without sanction, for when you work. And thirdly, and critically, if they give accurate real-time data on how much you will earn if you log on now, then we said in all those circumstances, you would not have a minimum wage claim if you chose to log on at a time of low demand.
Hello, and welcome to Upvote, a tech and politics podcast from Wired and Ars Technica UK. Kelly is back from her break. Hi, Kelly.
Hello.
And this week, we're delighted to be joined by Matthew Taylor, Chief Executive of the RSA. Matthew's just released a really big report into the future of work and modern working practices for the government. These reports are always a really big deal, and this one has been proved very interesting, I think. So it's great to have him here to discuss it. Matthew, thanks for coming in.
It's my pleasure.
We've actually known each other for quite a long time, haven't we?
Yeah, you worked for me, and you were too good for us.
that's very kind
of
you to say.
But in a kind of laid-back way.
A lazy, disaffected, clueless way, straight out of university.
Yeah, I mean, we had to get rid of you because you weren't really producing anything of any value, but that wasn't your fault. It was because we weren't ready for your brilliance.
I think that must have been it. Yeah, this was about 10 years ago, and you just finished as Chief of Strategy for Tony Blair, so you'd literally just come off the Prime Minister's helicopter, and then you were dealing with me, straight out of university, an utter incompetent. And back then, I was an ideas apprentice.
You were an ideas apprentice. I mean, there were a whole lot of things we did at the RSA in the early days, which were an attempt to miss out lots of stages of development. And then, depressingly, we had to go through all the stages of development. And now we would be a wonderful host for a man of your intellect and insight and innovative thinking. You would thrive at the RSA. But then you were an oyster sitting amongst a pile of stale cheese sandwiches.
Well, that's very kind of you. It's actually been quite funny to see this report because there's been a few issues around, or a few questions around just giving things different names, even though they're the same thing. But I'm sure we'll come on to that. First, though, I think the big focus is around technology and the way it's changing the nature of work. So there's a kind of long-term question around AI and robotics, but there's also this short-term question, and that really hones in on the gig economy. This is really the context for what your report is, isn't it?
Kind of. I think people felt when the report was set up that it was about that, modern employment, and that was the billing it was given. But if you look at the terms of reference that I was given, they were much broader, and I decided very early on to try to broaden my remit even further to talk about the quality of work in the British economy overall. And that's really for two reasons. First of all, because the gig economy actually is not that big still. If you talk about full-time employees, it's really small. If you include all the people who do a little bit of gig work on the side, it becomes a more significant part. Now, of course, it's likely to grow in the future, but it's not the most important and pressing issue in the labour market. And secondly, if you want to address the gig economy, you have to address the gig economy with a set of principles. Otherwise, why would you apply certain standards to the gig economy that you don't apply to other parts of the economy, other casual parts of the economy? So early on, I realised that, A, I wanted to talk about more than the gig economy, and B, if I was going to talk about the gig economy, I needed to have a broader set of principles that I could bring to bear on the particular issues raised by that gig economy.
Because basically, I mean, work's getting worse, isn't it, for most people? I guess that's the big context to all of this.
No, I'm not sure that's true, really. So,
well, real wages are down a long way, aren't
they?
Well,
you know, it's a mixed record, and there's a slight tendency for the discourse to lag a little bit behind the data. So first of all, it's always important to say that the British labour market is a pretty strong labour market, and many developed world countries would envy our record. I think I'm right in saying that if Italy had the same employment rate as the if we had the same employment rate as Italy, we would have 7 million fewer jobs. So, you know, we've got a lot of people working. We've got historically low unemployment rates. Most people who work flexibly, and I've had a lot of stick for saying this, but I'm going to carry on saying it because it's true. Most people who work flexibly choose to work flexibly. It is even the case that whilst you're right, of course, Roland, that overall we've suffered wage stagnation over the last decade, and indeed it was starting to happen even before the economic crisis. At the moment, interestingly, wages are rising fastest amongst the lowest paid. So for once, the labour market is being a kind of tool for redistribution, and that's a consequence of the national living wage and the tightening of the labour market. So I don't know how long that's going to last, but it's good that it's happening.
Because it seems to me that a lot of the stuff about the gig economy, it's around this idea that the gig economy in some way represents the vanguard, that more jobs are becoming more and more like the gig economy. I mean, I want to get into the detail.
Yeah. So I think that's let's explore that. So it's not really true, I don't think. Agency work hasn't really grown in recent years. 0 hours contracts looked like they grew, but that was probably because we didn't even have the term 0 hours contract. So I think a lot of people define themselves as 0 hours simply because that was a new terminology to describe what they've been doing for many years. And even 0 hours contracts looks like it's tailing off now. That growth has diminished. The really big thing, probably, I would say, is the rise of self-employment. So that's probably the most important thing that's happening. Apart from things that we know about, like the growth of, you know, women's employment, that's just about peaked now because we've almost got parity between male and female employment. So the growth of self-employment is an interesting thing because people have always assumed that was cyclical, that self-employment grows when conventional unemployment rises. But actually, self-employment started to grow after 2000. It's carried on growing. Now, again, it's not growing quite as fast, but self-employment now 15% of our labour market. And I think there are reasons to believe that self-employment, either full-time self-employment or self-employment where that's your main job, or bits of self-employment adding on to your other job or jobs, is something that will continue to grow.
Okay, well, maybe this is a good moment to get into the definitions a little bit, because this is a lot of what the questions around this revolve around. Okay, so we've got employed, you're in a job. We've got self-employed, that's when you work for yourself.
Yep.
And then there's the other category.
So there's a third category. So what we have in employment regulation is three broad categories. Employees who get all the benefits and entitlements that are attached to employment.
And we're talking, so, sick pay, maternity leave, paternity leave,
holiday pay, but critically also rights to claim unfair dismissal. That's one of the crucial aspects. So if you are an employee, you're not allowed to be sort of summarily dismissed. There have to be processes in place, and you can appeal against a dismissal that takes place, and there's redundancy arrangements and all those kinds of things. If you're a worker, you get most of those basic rights, although and this takes us to one or two of the recommendations in the report. A lot of people didn't know that they had those entitlements. It's something that we found. You have most entitlements, but you don't have this right to claim unfair dismissal. So what that means is that your hirer can lay you off, not give you work whenever they want to, and for whatever reasons. And that's one of the reasons why those workers feel much more vulnerable, because they really don't have any rights at all to continuous employment.
And just to butt in there, a worker is the name that's currently given to this other category.
I should continue. Imagine a kind of three-layer cake. At the bottom layer, you've got employees with the full set of rights. You've then got, sitting on top of that, slightly smaller workers who have most of those rights but not all of them. And then at the top, you have self-employed people who have some basic, more or less almost kind of human rights, but don't really have employment rights as a whole. To further complicate the picture, so that's employment regulation, but then, of course, you've got two other things. You've got tax rules, and unhelpfully, in tax, there are only two statuses. So in tax, there's simply an employee or self-employed. They don't have that middle category of worker. And then you've got the issue of entitlement to state benefits. And of course, one of the shifts that's taken place in recent years has been that self-employed people have gradually earned more entitlements to benefits at the same time as the level of tax which is generated by self-employed labour has fallen. So this is, bizarrely, this is a statistic I worked out at 5 o'clock in the morning, the day before the review was launched. I couldn't sleep. And It may be wrong, but from what I could calculate, when the welfare state was created, the tax on self-employed labour, the total tax raised by self-employed labour, that's the contribution of the self-employed person and their hirer, was two-thirds of the amount of tax raised on the labour of an employed person. That has now fallen to a third. So we've gradually increased the tax differential between what we charge, the tax we charge for self-employed labour and for employed labour. But yet, at the same time, we've gradually reduced the difference in terms of the entitlements that self-employed people and employed people have. So, for example, George Osborne, a few years ago, gave away entitlement to state pension to self-employed people. They hadn't previously had that entitlement. He gave that entitlement to them. I don't know. It will always be a mystery to me why he didn't use that as an opportunity to address some of the kind of tax imbalance, but he didn't.
Okay, so what do you think is actually the thing that's fueling the concerns with the gig economy? Is it that politicians are seeing more of these workers on the streets because you've got the likes of Deliveroo and Uber and so on, and you know the power of their apps and the fact that millions of people use them and things like that? Is that why it's kind of
a topic
of concern right now?
I think it's a complex picture. I think that part of it is novelty, as you say. Mm-hmm. Who are these people driving around with these big boxes on their back? So there's a kind of sense that this is something new, and we seem to be becoming increasingly anxious about anything that's new, which is a problem for us, of course. I think it's partly the companies themselves. You know, Uber is not a very attractive company, let's face it. And so people worry about those companies and they worry about their plan. And I think it's partly with the experience of people on those platforms. And, you know, as is the very nature of things, those people who have a bad experience have a louder voice, generally speaking, than those people who have a good experience. But, and again, this is something I've had a lot of stick for, but again, it's something supported by the data. Most people who work on Deliveroo or Uber say they're happy with it. It suits their lifestyle.
Okay, but I mean, today, for example, you've got Deliveroo workers protesting in Parliament because of the recent spate of acid attacks, and some of those guys have been targeted. So, you know, they're still demanding rights, regardless of what their employment status is.
Absolutely. And, you know, your right not to be attacked with acid does nothing to do with your employment status. That's your right as a citizen. And
Why are they protesting? If everything is actually okay for them, why?
Well, I mean, again, one of the challenges of this work around employment is that, and this is a mistake I've made. At the beginning when I started doing the review, the thing that really hit me after the first kind of few weeks was how complex this is. This is a very, very complicated area. I was sent an email by a barrister after I've been doing the review for about 2 weeks, and he said, I'm enclosing a speech that I made about employment status. And I opened it up, and to my utter horror, it was 54 pages long. But even more worrying than that was the message in the email that said, I'm afraid, Matthew, you'll find this is a rather superficial account. You know, so this is a very, very, very complex area. So, you know, if you take this question, so I didn't know that delivery drivers are protesting today. If they're protesting about the fact that they are being assaulted by people, this may be a protest about the police and negligence on the behalf of the police. Well, that's important, but that's nothing to do with their employment status. It could be anybody who's on the street doing that. If it's a complaint about the fact that Deliveroo is not making sufficient provision for them and addressing their health and safety, again, I think one would have to look at, well, to what extent is that to do with their employment status? What is that, the extent is that to do with the fact that Deliveroo just kind of aren't keeping up with the threats that they face? In terms of my review, it is clearly the implication of what I say that Deliveroo drivers and Uber drivers, as they are currently working, would probably be reclassified as workers and they would get workers' rights. The reason I don't state that as boldly as that is because it will take a couple of years for my recommendations to turn into law and be enacted. And that's 2 years for Deliveroo or Uber to change their business model, if they want to change their business model, in order that they can more legitimately claim that their drivers are self-employed. And let's remember, there are gig platforms, and TaskRabbit is a classic one, where nobody would say that anyone using that platform was a worker, because, you know, you negotiate your own rate, a whole variety of different jobs. And it is really basically just a way of intermediating between people who want handy people and handy people. Uber and Deliveroo feel different. They feel like different kinds of organisations, and that's what the Employment Tribunal appeal came to, the judgment it came to about Uber, when it said the idea that Uber is merely intermediating between passengers and drivers is not credible.
And where did you fall on that debate? I mean, do you think it's right to describe these kinds of apps as benign platforms?
Well, whether or not they're benign, the issue I was looking at was what should be the employment status of people who work through those apps. And as I have said, I think the clear implication of what we've said is that we would probably go with the courts, and the courts are generally speaking deciding that these people are workers rather than self-employed. But as I say, it is possible for those companies to change their business models, and indeed Deliveroo and Uber are continuously changing their practices. They stop short of defining their staff as workers, partly because of employment rights, but more importantly because of national insurance. They don't want to have to pay national insurance contributions on those people. But if you look at Uber and Deliveroo, their offer, particularly Uber actually, the offer they make to their drivers has grown and grown and grown as they've tried to portray themselves as a more benign organisation than they're often seen in the public mind.
Yeah. I mean,
just
on that point, Deliveroo said, in light of your report, we would welcome the opportunity to work with the government so we can end this trade-off between flexibility and security. I mean, do you think that they're being honest about that, or is that advantageous to them?
I kind of think they might be being honest, in as much as, based on the conversations, a couple of conversations I had with them on the margins of meetings. I didn't have any kind of one-to-one conversations with them. So, you know, this is a kind of subject of quite a lot of pain for me, really, because I think the solution that we came up with in order to allow the combination of flexibility and rights was pretty clever. The problem is it's quite complicated and not that many people understand it. So I will now, for your listeners, explain very clearly the solution we came up with and why it's clever. So what we argued was this. The first step is, if I am right that the implication of our work is that potentially Uber and Deliveroo drivers and couriers will be defined as workers, that creates an issue for those companies. And the issue is around the minimum wage, because if you're a worker, you're entitled to the minimum wage. Now, the characteristic of these platforms, the critical characteristic of these platforms that makes them different from almost any other employer, is the fact that you can work whenever you want to. And people kind of forget that. You know, you can't rock up to a strawberry farm in February and say, I want to pick strawberries now, right? You can only pick strawberries when the strawberry farm owner says, now there are strawberries. But you can sign on to Deliveroo and Uber whenever you want to. And those companies will say that they used to, but they don't punish people for signing on or signing off at any particular time. Now, this is the problem that it creates. The people who work on Uber and Deliveroo like that. They don't want to work shifts. They like the fact that they can log on whenever they want to. But the problem is this. If you can log on whenever you want to, and if you're entitled to minimum wage when you log on, the danger, of course, is in such a system, we will realise that what we should do is set our alarm at 2 o'clock in the morning, log on for Deliveroo. Not many people want pizzas at 2 o'clock in the morning, so we can lie in bed. We might occasionally have to get up and deliver a pizza, but we can happily be earning our minimum wage doing nothing. In those circumstances, Deliveroo would have to say no. Well, we have to control the number of people who are working, and then you move to a shift system. So, brilliant, in my view. I don't care if it sounds arrogant. We thought very hard about it. Our brilliant response to this was to say the following. If the platform, and these platforms have huge amount of data, if the platform can demonstrate that the average worker working averagely hard earns 1.2 times the minimum wage, so not just the minimum wage, 1.2, that means even if you're not terribly efficient, you'll still get the minimum wage. If secondly, they continue to adhere to this way of working, which is you can work whenever you want to without sanction for when you work. And thirdly, and critically, if they give accurate real-time data on how much you will earn if you log on now, then we said in all those circumstances, you would not have a minimum wage claim if you chose to log on at a time of low demand. So, you know, if you're, I don't know, I would say Ipswich, I don't know why I use Ipswich in this example, but it's a Monday afternoon in Ipswich, you're a student, you're summer holiday, you want to earn a bit of extra money, you go to the Deliveroo app. The Deliveroo app says not many people getting takeaways at the moment. You probably only get about £4.20 an hour. If you want to go and sit outside the Deliveroo office reading The Guardian and chatting to your mates and occasionally delivering a pizza for £4.20 an hour, I don't think the law should ban you from doing that or should force Deliveroo to say, no, you can't work, you have to have a shift. So that's the solution. Now, a lot of people misunderstood this. A lot of people thought this was some generalised exemption to the minimum wage at all. It's not at all. It's a very demanding set of conditions, but it does mean that Deliveroo or Uber, if they want to, could call people workers, could pay tax on their workers, but could continue to have this most valued aspect of their model, which is the fact that people can work whenever they want to. Because, sorry that's long-winded, but it is so important that people understand it.
Because... So what? So the main criticism, I'd say, coming from unions, just to kind of be clear about this, is that they say, look, the minimum wage is the minimum wage. You should be paid it whenever, because it's sacrosanct. And what you're doing is you're offering this exception to something which just should be a flat baseline.
Yeah, and I understand that.
And is that but
I understand that, but
the because they right. literally just haven't clever enough to have understood brilliant proposal.
No, I think that they don't really want these platforms to exist. That's the truth of it. I mean, so when I say to trade unionists, but if you do that, you know that these platforms would have to have shifts, and you know that they would deny their drivers and couriers the right to work whenever they want to. Their general attitude is to shrug their shoulders and say, so what? Now, I know, I've spoken to those drivers, and that's not what they want. And, you know, there's two issues here. One is, generally speaking, I don't think the law should stop people doing things that they choose to do, and where, as it were, there's no malign externality. You know, if you choose to work at a time of low demand and get less than minimum wage, that's, you know, no one else is harmed by that choice. So I don't think the law should interfere there. But secondly, politically, I didn't want in my report to recommend something which would lead almost immediately to Uber and Deliveroo drivers on the airwaves saying, we don't want any of these protections because it will take away the one thing that we most like, which is the freedom to work whenever we want to.
I want to talk about the political implications of this, because obviously... I mean, they're large, and this, to be clear, this report is only recommendations that will have to be enacted by a possible government. But just on this, the other thing that people say, the critics say, is that you're giving a lot of control to the platform over this. They can come up with the data. They can say around this kind of issue of 1.2.
No, there'd have to be total transparency on the data. You know, I mean, and one of the good things I can say, and I'm not hostile to these platforms, is they are always banging on about their data. And they've got very sophisticated data. They would have to make their data completely, transparently accessible. And to be honest, if they started playing games, people would pretty soon know that. So if people found that they were logging on and told you're going to earn £4.20 the next day and they actually only earn £1.80, they'd be soon enough saying, well, this data doesn't seem to be accurate. So I think you've got... you know, enough consumer power, as it were, to be able to make sure that if these platforms say something, that they're being that it's being adhered to.
Really? Because in general, I would say, as a rule, companies have more ability to get around this stuff than workers. And in a way, I'm talking from personal experience here, because Kelly and I work in an industry that's being massively disrupted. I'd say our kind of chief overlords now are Facebook and Google, and when it comes to getting data out of them, it's really hard.
No, but
this isn't in a court of law, obviously.
I agree. But Ronald, this is the key point. What we're saying is you would not have this minimum wage exemption unless you were A, able to prove, not just assert, but prove that the average worker was earning 1.2 times the minimum wage plus, and prove that the real-time information was accurate. So if you don't want to do that, if you don't want to hand your data over, if you want to be like Google or Facebook and keep your data, that's fine, but you won't get the minimum wage exemption. What we're doing is offering those companies, if they want to, and they're willing to be totally transparent about their data, a way of continuing to have their business model whilst also meeting workers, giving workers rights and, critically, paying national insurance contributions.
Ah, so it's the default is that you don't get this unless you prove... otherwise.
Yeah, absolutely.
Except that, Deliveroo wouldn't suddenly switch over to the new system. They'd be in the non-default, wouldn't they? Because they're kind of currently
There's a lot of steps. So first of all, the law would have to change. Secondly, if Deliveroo chose to continue to contest it, in the courts it would have to be tested, and the courts would have to say, no, we think your couriers are workers, and hopefully making the law a bit simpler, which we advocate, would make that a speedier process. And also, of course, there are changes to the employment tribunal process that would make it easier for workers to make that claim. So that happens, and at that point, yes, Deliveroo would have a choice, and the choice would be to say, okay, we're going to move to a kind of shift system. Or they could say, well, we're going to pay minimum wage to people whenever they clock on, but I think their business would pretty soon go bankrupt if they did that. So they could either say, well, actually, we will go to a shift system, and as I understand it, there are parts of the world where Deliveroo do have full-time employees, where they don't have this kind of flexibility. Or if they want to maintain that flexibility, they would have to have an arrangement with, you know, the inspector, with the, with HMRC, I guess it would be, and wouldn't necessarily have to publish their data in the public domain, but they'd have to make sure that data was available to HMRC. So if anyone came along with a minimum wage infringement claim, HMRC would be able to say, okay, let's just go and check the data. And if it was found that they weren't paying 1.2 times minimum wage to the average worker, or they weren't providing accurate real-time data, they would lose that minimum wage claim. That's the critical point. If they didn't provide that data, they would lose a minimum wage claim.
So is there an appetite for legislation, you know, with the government? I mean, Theresa May asked for this review.
Well,
there's been plenty of criticism.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I let me be honest with you. That's a terrible thing to say, because it sounds like I've been dishonest otherwise. But I'm kind of slightly ambivalent at the moment. I mean, I'm very proud of the review, actually. And I think there was one thing we got wrong, which I'm happy to talk about. We didn't explain clearly enough. But I think the rest of it is robust. And in fact, you know, just today I read that in New York they've just created a kind of variable minimum wage, which looks just like the variable minimum wage which we advocated, and which actually felt 2 or 3 months ago like a highly controversial idea. So, you know, I'm very pleased with the review, but I have to make a decision. You know, do I kind of say, look, it's there, it's out there, you know, it's up to you, government, it's up to you, civil society, what you make of it, I've done the best that I can, or do I carry on kind of proselytizing for it and arguing for it? And, you know, I've got a day job, I run the RSA. You know, I that's something that I'm weighing up at the moment. If I felt there was something I could do to make it more likely that it would be implemented, then I would be keen to do that. But what I don't want to do is to be a kind of backseat driver, kind of every 2 weeks nagging the government. You know, I used to work in government. I know how hard government is. Theresa May hasn't got a majority. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's, in a way, although this process was really hard, and, you know, like any public policy making, you have emotional highs and lows, moments when you think you've got no good ideas, moments when you think you can change the world. In the end, what we did was the easy bit. We've established a set of principles and ideas. The tough bit is the detailed implementation of those ideas. And I'm not going to kind of stand outside government beating them up for the fact that it might be that when they look at some of these things, it turns out that they're harder to implement than we thought.
Yeah, I mean, presumably also because we've got the opposition, you know, with reinvigorated Jeremy Corbyn under the Labour Party. He has very strong views anyway, and you know, there's support there from the unions and so on in terms of workers' rights and the gig economy and so on. So would it be very difficult to get a bill of that nature through Parliament in the first place?
Labour weren't keen, were they?
Well, it's a kind of interesting question, this, isn't it? Because, you know, probably if you were to look at the kind of top eight demands that trade unions had, we've probably, in one way or another, accepted most of those. Maybe not to the full degree that the trade unions might have wanted, but we have accepted them in a whole variety of ways. You know, abolishing the Swedish derogation, shifting the burden of proof in employment tribunals, this variable minimum wage idea in order to get companies to think much harder about whether they can guarantee hours. You know, allowing, making sure that every worker gets information on day one of their employment about their rights, the ability to roll up holiday pay, which, by the way, will probably mean a significant increase in the salaries of the lowest paid. So there's a lot there. So I guess if it comes to Parliament, the question for Labour is, well, this is kind of 8 out of 10. Are we going to say, no, you can't have 8 out of 10 because it's not 10 out of 10? Or are we going to say, yeah, you can have 8 out of 10, but by the way, if you elect Labour, we'll add the extra 2? I mean, it seems to me that from the public's perspective, they would want Labour to take the 8 out of 10 and offer the extra 2 rather than demolish the entire thing. But, you know, politics is a bit ugly at the moment, and whether or not, you know, I've written a lot about this. There's a kind of always a conflict between the world of policy, which is kind of rational and pragmatic, and the world of policy, of politics. Mm-hmm. And the world of politics is kind of adversarial and winner takes all, and, you know, so this will be a battle that I've seen played out over and over again, the battle between policy and politics, and we'll see what wins.
Because one big thing that you did under Blair, I think you said it was your proudest achievement, was the Child Trust Fund.
Yeah, and that went.
Yeah, I know. I mean, how do you avoid... in fact, just on that, it's quite interesting the relationship between the Child Trust Fund and universal basic income, and how those two, the idea of giving people money is suddenly back in vogue. But anyway, How do you avoid this having the same fate? I mean, from your experience in government, is there anything you can do, or is it just literally like, well...
No, you can't. Look, what you have to do in policymaking is, especially, and this is a luxury you have if you're outside government in particular, is you have to recognise that there's a big centre for public impact study of successful policy all around the world that was published a few weeks ago. And what it argued was there were three things that made for, they increased the chances of success for policy. Policy. So that's what we're talking about, you know, technocratically written policy, policy designed as well as you can possibly design it, which I think we've done pretty well in this review, actually. Secondly, legitimacy, which is the public understands what you're trying to do, believe it's possible, support it. And I work very hard throughout the review to talk about good work and try to get legitimacy for the things that I was trying to do. And I think we did good work in that regard. Then the third is action, which is actually when you implement something, being realistic about people's incentives and priorities and having a policy which in the end does flow down into real action at the front line. And that action bit, that implementation bit, is something which government now has to consider. We didn't really get into that in great detail. We only worked for 10 months.
How are you within the Labour Party these days? How are you treated by the Labour Party these days? I'm on your Wikipedia page. It still says Matthew Taylor, Labour politician.
Yeah, no, and I've tried to change that.
There's a thing like Wikipedia. You can just go in and change it.
No, I know, but I don't know. Apparently, anyway.
I'm only teasing you.
But fine. Perhaps I don't care enough about my image. I don't know, but look. I spoke to Labour politicians throughout the process. I briefed Labour politicians before the report was published. I think the response of most Labour politicians to the report was balanced and positive. The response of the trade unions was less balanced and less positive. And people are at pains to tell me that the trade unions were kind of acting on political instructions. But I don't know. That's gossip. I've no idea. You know, I value trade unions. My first job was with the trade union. I was sad at some of the kind of knee-jerk responses. I was mystified as to why it is that a report that contains so many things that trade unions have argued for was dismissed in that way. But, you know, maybe when people kind of calm down, when they've actually read the report, wiser counsel will prevail.
I think they've read it.
Well, some of the reaction was from people who must be speed readers then. I mean, certainly one trade union general secretary was able to dismiss it, and he must be, you know, he must have remarkable capacity to read.
Because the IWGB, this new trade union, they released a 64-page report responding to your 116 pages, I think, is that right? Mm-hmm. And their report was called Dead on Arrival. I mean, they're the new union, which has been set up specifically for these kind of workers.
Yeah, and I don't agree. I mean, look, there are a number of ways in which you can criticise the review. And, you know, what I want to do is to accept those criticisms on their merits. But you need to. So there was one set of criticisms, which is the problem with your review is that it, as it were, seeks to work with the prevailing political, social, economic realities. So, you know, one critique says what you should have argued for was a German-style national collective bargaining with trade unions sitting with government and agreeing national wage rates. Now, fine. But, you know, that isn't the British tradition. There's not much chance of that happening at the moment. And I wasn't really in the business in the review of advocating things which have got a very, very limited chance of succeeding and which don't even seem to really reflect the kind of assumptions that we have in this country. So that's fine. You can have a set of criticisms that says, I wish the world was different. And what the review should have done was to imagine a different world rather than dealing with the world as it is. Then there are other criticisms which are about some of the detail of it. And certainly I think that organisation has misconstrued one of our key recommendations and has got slightly obsessed with that misconstruction of it. So, first of all, it's not clear to me they fully understand the minimum wage proposal that I've discussed with you now. They do somehow think that this is giving control to those companies, and I'm at pains to say no, it isn't. What it is doing is saying to those companies, if there are certain things that you could do that might inoculate you from a minimum wage claim. That's all it's saying. But the other thing is around this issue of dependent contractors, and that is where I would accept criticism, actually, because I think that we were insufficiently clear about this. Earlier, Roland, you asked me to describe these three categories, self-employed, worker and employee. The fact is, within the worker category, there are different types of people. So agency workers are within the worker category, but agency workers have their own rules. So there are certain, so in fact, some agency workers have better rights in some ways than non-agency workers. all that we were arguing was that you might imagine that there'd be a new category within the worker category called dependent contractors. That did not in any way mean that that category would not have workers' rights, would not be subject to national insurance payments. So it wasn't. So that body has tended to assume that what we're talking about is some kind of new category, which is sub-worker, somehow has lower rights than workers, lower entitlements workers. All we were saying was, maybe there's a name that you could use to describe this new way of working, just as we've got a way to name it to describe agency workers.
I mean, another criticism, I'm sorry that we're keeping those rolling, but another criticism of the review is a problem with who sat on the panel. And for example, there was a member called Greg Marsh, who was a former Deliveroo investor, and he didn't sell his stake in the company until 4 months after the review began. So, I mean, that's a bit of a conflict of interest issue, arguably.
Am I allowed to say bollocks? I
mean,
it's absolute bollocks, to be honest. I mean, look.
But sorry, the
argument is, you know, I mean, look, you know, fair enough. If people want to address a set of serious issues by pointing out that somebody who is pretty wealthy had a small number of shares which he sold, not in order to maximise his income, but in order that he could serve for free. And he put a lot of time and a lot of work into this.
He agreed
to sell the shares as soon as he came onto the panel. It took that time to offload them. I asked Greg to come on the panel. He told me, he told the Cabinet Office that he had these shares, and we said, well, you need to sell them. He said, I'm very happy to do that, and he set that thing in process. As I say, you know, Greg is you know, he's a well-off individual who dedicated a lot of time and energy. He came round the country with me. I mean, the other two members of the review, Diane and Paul, were great, but they weren't able to give much time. You know, Greg came on a lot of the visits with me. He made a really useful contribution. And the idea that he would... What is the assumption? The assumption is that somehow Greg inveigled himself in order that he could make money on his shares, even though he didn't have his shares when the report published, and even though the report probably means that Deliveroo would have to change its business model, pay national insurance. I mean, it is bollocks, to be honest, and it doesn't help our public discourse when people kind of try to make arguments of that kind, because what it actually does is it discourages people from public service. You know, I mean, look, you know, before you ask me, I have taken Uber taxis. You know, once we get into this business...
Matthew, come on, though. I mean, but realistically, you can see why people don't like that, can't you?
Well, I don't like the fact that somebody sold their shares before a report published.
But it just makes it seem like he's made up his mind beforehand because he supports this company financially. I mean, what you're saying is almost like Donald Trump. I was the first person to mention him. But when he says, if I've got rich people in my cabinet, that means they can't be influenced.
Yeah, but look, point out, he divested himself of the shares. He declared he had that interest and he divested himself of the shares. That's it, full stop. I don't know what the story is. If he bought... look, if he'd been on the panel and he'd bought loads of Deliveroo shares, right? And then the review had said, you know what, Deliveroo, you carry on. You know, there's not going to be any kind of challenges to the way you work. Well, then fine, be suspicious. But he divested himself of the shares. And as I've been trying to explain to you, the review is challenging to Deliveroo. It is challenging to the way that they work. It kind of assumes, unless they change their business model, that the people who work for them will be workers and they'll have to pay tax. So I just find it alarming when actually what we have in this country is we have fewer and fewer people who want to put themselves forward for public service, because when they do that, they put themselves in the firing line for the kind of worst kinds of assumptions about what motivates people. So the reason I get het up about it is partly because of Greg, because he worked really closely on this review and he made a really useful contribution to it, but also because it's just part of this general assumption, which is the second you try to put yourself into the frame of doing something in the public interest, then, you know, any kind of stuff can be thrown at you. And that's bad. That's bad for our society.
But then was Greg's presence on the panel offset by any representation from trade union or workers' representation?
Right, so let's look at this panel. I can't believe how much time you're spending on this. And I can't. You could do a lot better. To be honest, you could do better than this, but I will finish the point. There were four people on the panel. One is the chief executive of a regulatory body, the Gangmasters Licensing Authority. It's not called that anymore, but whatever its full name is. So he is a regulator. So what you could say is, oh, that's not very good. You had somebody on your panel who's a regulator. He's going to be biased towards regulation. And then we had an employment lawyer. So, well, no, you don't want her on the panel because she's biased towards complicated law, because complicated law favours employment lawyers. And anyway, she works in the private sector, so she's bound to be biased towards the private sector. And then, my goodness, the chair, what was his first job with? With a trade union. Oh, well, that shows, you know, how could you have someone chairing this whose first job was with the trade union, who's been a trade union member, who's spoken at lots and lots of trade union meetings, whose MA was in industrial relations? Clearly, this is someone who can't be trusted. Once you get into the assumption that people who take up public office are incapable of making an objective judgment about what's in the public interest without delving into some deep hidden reason why it is that they're trying to manipulate the process, it's just a waste of time.
I mean, to be fair, Matthew, I don't think that was the point. I was actually asking if he's...
Well, I've described the panel to you. There's a regulator, a solicitor, a lefty, and an entrepreneur.
I mean, the criticism was about him being 4 months in without having...
There's no without. He declared at the outset he offered to divest himself of the shares. It took 4 months to do it. He told us at the beginning and he said, will it be a problem? And I said, no, you'll have to sell them. He said, fine. Mm-hmm. That's it.
Yeah.
I've got the emails from him at the beginning. I've got these shares, me saying, the Cabinet Office and me saying, would you mind getting rid of them? No, I'm happy to get rid of them.
You okay. Know? Well, we will endeavour to do better to end the podcast. I wanted to talk a bit more broadly about the relationship between technology and politics. I know you've been thinking about this for a long time. This is our kind of obsession here. Do you remember that you came and kind of sat on it? Was it like a dinner, like one of those dinners that we do occasionally here? And that was off the record. But you were kind of, I think I could say in broad terms, quite critical about the way that you felt like the technology was changing politics and not for the better. I mean, is that something that you feel broadly? Or is actually everything heading more or less in the right direction?
I mean, I thought we were going to talk about technology and work. We haven't talked about it at all, but...
Well, we can talk about that. We can talk about that if you like.
Well,
we're
running out of time, but, you know, we've spent so long talking about other things that we haven't talked about technology and work, which is what I came here to talk about, which is the most interesting topic. But... technology and politics. Look, I think there is growing evidence that social media does, and certain social media platforms like Twitter do encourage a particular type of pretty ugly discourse, and I think that is a problem. Yeah, I do, and I think what we're learning, and Evgeny Morozov said this in, you know, his great book several years ago, is that. There's kind of two positions. One is technology doesn't really matter. You know, if people weren't using Twitter, they'd be standing on street corners hurling abuse. And the other view is technological determinism, that somehow Twitter is responsible for the fact that people get angry. What Morozov argues is that individual platforms have particular ways of working and encourage particular behaviours and norms. And I think that's right. And I think that we are seeing that there are certain attributes of Facebook and of Twitter and of other social media platforms which lend themselves towards particular forms of expression. And yes, I think that is problematic. I think it's something we need to think very hard about, because if it is true that certain platforms seem to lead to more extreme expressions, more ugly expressions, more violent expressions, more polarization, then that is a real social problem. I'm not saying the answer is to kind of ban things, but we do need to take that seriously.
And on work, actually, it sounds like you think the picture is more optimistic than many people do.
Well, you know, had we talked about technology and work, it's an interesting and complex topic. So I think that there are a lot of statistics thrown around about the future work, that 30% of jobs, 40% of jobs are going to go. I don't think that's right. I think that what's actually going to happen is that the content of jobs will change, the tasks within jobs will change. I think that quite a lot of the speculation about technology and jobs doesn't explore, for example, the importance of business models. You know, had we been standing here 15 years ago, we would possibly be moaning the kind of end of the music industry, because we just said, well, you know, free downloads, that's it, it's all over. What we didn't predict was two things. One is that music would become much more ubiquitous. When I was young, this will be remarkable to your listeners, but when I was young, I used to have to go into a special room to listen to music. You used to say to your friends, shall we go and listen to music? Because there was a room where you did it. And now, of course, everyone wanders around all the time listening to music. And secondly, of course, the rise of live. So similarly, I think that what will happen is that technology will change jobs, it will change the tasks within jobs, and new business models will emerge. But what I do think, and this is a point that we did make in our report, is that when we think about that technological change, we need to think about it with values in mind. And that's why I emphasise so much in my report the principle of good work, that the aim of technological change should be to enrich people's jobs, that technology removes the drudgery and the danger from jobs and leaves people with the stuff that they love, which is the creativity and caring and human interaction. So, you know, and the other thing about technology is that we've got to find a way of getting through what is sometimes called the Engels pause, which is, you know, after the Industrial Revolution, living standards didn't rise for three generations before we started to see greater affluence. Now, that, you know, that's possible in a world where you don't have voting and where the king can send the troops in when people protest. That's not the world we live in now. So we're going to have to find a way of transitioning from where we are now to where we might be, and things like universal basic income come into that conversation. Because what we can't say to people is, look, put up with all this technological dislocation. It won't help you, it won't help your children, but it'll help your grandchildren. That's just not a politically tenable position.
Well, Matthew, thank you very much for coming in. I'm sorry we couldn't talk more about the topics you wanted.
Yeah, me too.
But perhaps another time. Thank you again.